The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the October 14th, 2022 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week has in the foreground Russian President Vladimir Putin. He's got a stern look on his face, and his finger is pointing directly at the observer up close and personal. It's covered in blood. In the background over his shoulder is a war scene. It's there's a lot of smoke in the background. You can see a tank on fire. And running away from him into the battle scene are, I guess, a bunch of Russian soldiers, some of whom look like they're wounded already. The headline is Russia in Retreat. As Putin escalates his threats, his army rapidly loses ground to Ukraine's counteroffensive. That is our first main story. We'll start there. Ukraine advances on two fronts. What happened? With growing confidence, Ukrainian troops forced the retreat of crumbling Russian forces in the country's south and east this week, even as Russia formalized the annexation of four partially occupied Ukrainian regions. Ukrainian forces recaptured Lyman, a strategically important railway hub in the eastern Donetsk region, crippling Russian supply lines and creating a staging ground for an advance into the Russian-held Luhansk province. The reclamation of Lyman came just hours after a ceremony in which Putin claimed the town and the entire Donetsk region as Russian territory, and followed an abrupt retreat by Russian forces. "They are running, and we are running after them," laughed a jubilant Ukrainian tank commander, Ihor Nazarenko. As the eastern counteroffensive pushed forward, Ukrainian troops also regained a large swath of territory in the southern Kherson region, liberating dozens of towns and villages in a fast and powerful advance, said Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Putin and Russia's parliament made official the annexation of the four Ukrainian regions, an act that drew broad international condemnation. Putin warned that he'll consider any attacks on the seized territory, whose exact borders are unclear, as an attack on Russian soil. He gave a rambling, combative speech in which he cast the war as an existential battle against the West and declared he would use all available means to defend Russian territory. Addressing political and military officials in a Kremlin grand hall, he assailed the United States for Satanism and said Western elites seek to destroy Russia and enslave its people. He again raised the specter of a nuclear response, saying the atomic bombs the U.S. dropped on Japan during World War II had created a precedent. Russian forces' retreat from Lyman prompted a rare rebuke of Russian commanders by some prominent Putin allies and media figures. "Send all these pieces of garbage barefoot with machine guns straight to the front," said oligarch Yevgeny Prigozhin, the founder of Wagner Group, a mercenary outfit. Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov called for military leaders to take more drastic measures, including the use of low-yield nuclear weapons. What the editorial said: Putin is a wounded animal who is getting more dangerous, said the New York Daily News. His bellicose speech made clear he believes Russia is at war not just with Ukraine, but with the post-Soviet global order. His paranoia and nuclear saber-rattling should worry us all. As Ukrainian forces steamroll his poorly trained, poorly led army, he's running out of options, except for the most drastic one, the lever he can pull when all else fails. Putin's speech was scary stuff, said the Washington Post, but facts on the ground matter more than rants at the Kremlin. He's amping up his rhetoric precisely because his army is collapsing and his hold on power is in jeopardy. President Biden and NATO leaders must hold steady and maintain the flow of arms that are empowering Ukraine's battlefield wins. And they must watch vigilantly for any sign of nuclear deployment, which should trigger intense diplomatic and other pressure on Putin to stop before setting off a nuclear catastrophe. What the columnist said, Putin's attempt to bolster his flagging forces by mobilizing 300,000 Army reservists was doomed before it began, said Doug Klein in Foreign Policy. The untrained, under-equipped, and largely unwilling new recruits bound for the front are destined to become cannon fodder, which is why as many as 700,000 Russians have fled the country since he ordered the call-up. As Ukraine's highly motivated, very professional army gains momentum, the new Russian soldiers' reports of abysmal conditions and rusty rifles are triggering panic back home. Putin's nuclear threats are stirring growing alarm in Washington, said David Sanger in the New York Times. Officials are gaming out scenarios and weighing how to respond if Putin employs a tactical nuclear weapon. The odds he'll make good on his threats are low, they believe, given the furious international response it would unleash. But they are far more worried about the possibility now than at any point since Putin invaded 8 months ago. The nuclear threat is real, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. It's nuclear weapons that made the Soviet Union a superpower, and a cornered, beleaguered Putin wants that stature back. The Biden administration is caught between yielding to Russian blackmail and risking deepening engagement in an escalating war. The world faces its most dangerous moment since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, said Paul Miller in the Dispatch. With a deepening crisis on the battlefield, Putin has no path to victory, but to back down would be to acknowledge defeat by Ukraine and, by extension, the U.S., a pill he can never swallow. So while breaking the nuclear taboo appears irrational to us, it may look different to him. For the imperiled Russian strongman, this war is existential. He wins or he dies. We have a second main story. Ian's death toll rises as recovery efforts begin. What happened? Hurricane Ian's death toll climbed past 100 as Florida sifted through the wreckage of the Category 4 storm and launched massive recovery efforts. Over half of the casualties were in Lee County, with the barrier island towns of Fort Myers Beach and Sanibel sustaining extensive damage. A week after the hurricane hit the Gulf Coast, more than 500,000 people remained without power. Rescue crews went door-to-door to find survivors, and over 1,900 trapped residents were rescued by boat and aircraft. However, many Floridians still could not contact family members. One woman said she last spoke to her uncle, who decided to ride out the storm in Lee County as water was filling his home. His body was found in a canal 2 days later. It will take years to rebuild the hardest-hit coastal areas, and total damages are estimated to reach at least $66 billion. Meteorologists initially predicted Ian would make landfall further north, near Tampa, while the country's main forecast model said it would reach Florida as only a Category 2 hurricane. Relying on those forecasts, Lee County's emergency managers failed to issue a mandatory evacuation order until one day before the storm hit, which didn't give residents adequate time to leave. The delay appears to have violated the county's evacuation strategy, but Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, expected to be a leading contender for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024, has defended the county's actions. President Biden traveled to Florida this week to survey the wreckage and meet with state officials. "We have one job and only one job," he said, standing alongside DeSantis, "and that's to make sure the people in Florida get everything they need to fully, thoroughly recover." What the editorial said. "Already the finger pointing has started," said the Miami Herald. Whose fault is it that so many people remained in harm's way when a monster of a storm like Ian hit? Lee County officials, DeSantis, residents determined to live by the ocean, all of them bear some responsibility. Our first priority must be providing emergency relief, but then we have to learn the terrible lessons of Ian. The best way to do that is an unflinching examination of exactly what did and didn't happen. We wouldn't be hearing all these demands to apportion blame if DeSantis weren't a national political juggernaut, said the Washington Examiner. The biased media politicized Ian from the start, and it's both deeply unfair and also untrue to say that Florida wasn't prepared. The death toll may be climbing, but given the storm's unexpected turn, every reasonable person recognizes that the efforts of state, local, and federal officials have prevented a much greater tragedy. What the columnist said: this is a story of a ravaging storm, severely shifting winds, and gusts of hot air, said Steve Israel in The Hill. And I'm not talking about Hurricane Ian. When Hurricane Sandy ravaged the Northeast in 2012, then Representative DeSantis voted against Congress's relief package. But he's since demonstrated an ability to overcome hypocrisy with dexterity. Now that his state needs federal aid, he's claiming we're all in the same boat. He's learned that it was easy to be a Tea Party blowhard. It's tougher to govern when the winds blow hard. And as that aid is distributed, we need to address inequality and racial disparities, said Anna Rhodes and Max Besbris in NBCNews.com. Homeowners in wider and wealthier communities are likely to see their home values rebound more quickly. The greater ability of well-off households to afford insurance, as well as FEMA's rules for allocating assistance, factor into how climate-related disasters make our communities more unequal. Without changes to recovery policies, disasters like Hurricane Ian are increasingly going to be a cause of inequality. But if Ian can teach us anything, it's that there is no choice but to adapt to the climate change we have caused, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. There's an emotional logic to rebuilding the devastated areas just as they were. But Ian presents an opportunity to reimagine Florida's climate-vulnerable cities and rebuild with storm-resistant buildings that can withstand high winds and rising tides, and consider whether beachfront island homes should be rebuilt at all. We can either create a doomed monument to an unrecoverable past or a vision of a resilient future. Controversy of the week: Supreme Court, why there's a crisis of legitimacy. The Supreme Court term that ended in June with the repeal of Roe v. Wade was the most consequential and, for progressives, the most damaging in living memory, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. The justices returned this week for a new term of possibly momentous cases, with the liberal and conservative justices openly debating whether the court's radical assault on precedent had risked its legitimacy. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson begins her tenure as the first black woman in the court's history, but she will be powerless to stop a 6-3 conservative supermajority from rewriting U.S. law to match the policy preferences of the Republican Party. Their targets this term will include affirmative action in college admissions, anti-LGBTQ discrimination laws, and the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to protect water. Most ominously, the court will consider a once-fringe constitutional theory that would give state legislatures all but absolute control over elections, making redistricting maps, election rules, and even declarations of fraud immune to judicial review. A slew of 6-3 conservative rulings would only accelerate the court's precipitous decline in public esteem, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. A June poll found that only 25% of Americans had a lot of confidence in the court, an all-time low. And that was before the cataclysmic Dobbs decision. But the emboldened majority shows no signs of slowing their ideological rampage. Chief Justice John Roberts put it well in a recent speech, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Simply because people disagree with an opinion, he said, is not a basis for criticizing the legitimacy of the court. The left is angry because it has lost the court as a backup legislature for its policy goals. So liberals are trying to undermine the whole institution. Roberts' denialism is troubling, said Amy Davidson Sorkin in The New Yorker. As Justice Elena Kagan rebutted him in a recent speech of her own, judges create legitimacy problems for themselves by discarding decades of precedent to impose their own personal preferences. When justices are replaced and the law suddenly changes, Kagan said, it doesn't look like law. How the justices were replaced is another problem, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. The court would have a 5-4 liberal majority if Republicans hadn't spent 9 months blocking President Obama's nominee to replace Justice Antonin Scalia and then rushed to confirm Amy Coney Barrett about a week before the 2020 election. Rather than proceed cautiously after that outrageous power play, the new justices are consistently siding with the Republican Party. This term's case of the independent state legislature theory poses perhaps the greatest threat of all, said Albert Hunt in The Hill. If the court gives Republican state officials an effective license to steal an election, it could be a death blow to our democracy. We are already on that road, said Ellie Mistel in The Nation. In a democracy, the people govern themselves and vote out elected officials who don't do what the people want. But it has become clear that we are now more of a juristocracy, where an unelected council of rulers imposes laws that most people don't want. This isn't the first time in our history that courts have stopped listening to the people, said the New York Times in editorial. If the justices continue down their radical path, the people's voices will eventually become too loud for them to ignore. And here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for bargains after Will Sedary of Maine paid $75 at an estate sale for a page of sheet music that has now been verified to date from the 13th century. The find could be worth $10,000. It was a good week for humility after actor Tom Hanks said in an interview that of the 94 films he's made, 4 of them are pretty good. Hanks, 66, who has been nominated for 6 Academy Awards and won 2, didn't specify which 4 pretty good films he meant. It was a good week for incels, with the launch by Trump supporters of The Right Stuff, an invite-only dating app for right-of-center singles. The Right Stuff encourages users to open up by completing the sentence, January 6 was... or by sharing their favorite liberal lie. But it was a bad week for visitors after a resident of Fort Myers, Florida, videoed what appeared to be a young shark swimming along a street flooded by Hurricane Ian. Experts said that this footage appears authentic, unlike every other past video of a shark in a flooded street. It was a bad week for irony, with reports that dozens of Venezuelan asylum seekers in New York City are being offered cash and quietly bused to Florida to help in the hurricane cleanup. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recently had Venezuelan asylum seekers flown north to highlight blue states' alleged hypocrisy on immigration. And it was a bad week for futurism after Ian destroyed what was left of the Cape Romano Dome House in Marco Island, Florida. The distinctive group of concrete interlocking geodesic domes was erected in 1982 as a model for the hurricane-proof beach house of the future. But the beach beneath it eroded away. Briefing this week is Europe's surging far right. Far right parties in Sweden and Italy just had electoral breakthroughs. Why? Where is the far right growing? In the last month, far right parties in Sweden and Italy shocked the world with their electoral successes. The Brothers of Italy, a descendant of Mussolini's fascist regime, garnered 26% of votes to place first in the Italian election, up from 4% in 2018. Led by Giorgia Meloni, who has spoken of LGBT lobbies and claimed American billionaire George Soros finances mass immigration, the party uses a fascist slogan and a logo that was created for the neo-fascist in the 1940s. Meanwhile, in Sweden, a country known for tolerance and a robust social safety net, the far-right Sweden Democrats placed second in September elections with 20%. The party has roots in a neo-Nazi movement and campaigned on cracking down on soaring violent crime. Far-right parties are also ascendant in France, Germany, Belgium, and Spain. France's far-right National Rally placed second in this year's presidential election, claiming more than 40% of votes in its best showing ever. Why are these parties more popular? In recent years, a major influx of immigrants from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Africa has unsettled many Europeans. Islamist terrorist attacks on European soil had already created fear and suspicion of Muslim immigrants, which deepened when impoverished immigrant communities on the outskirts of suburbs of big cities gave rise to violent drug gangs and crime. After taking in 150,000 refugees starting in 2015, Sweden has gone from having one of the lowest per capita rates of deadly shootings in Europe to the highest. Just before its recent election, a mother and child were killed by stray bullets during a gang fight at a playground, causing a national furor. "It's getting worse and worse in terms of violent crime," said Torsten Ellefsen, a former police chief who became a candidate for the center-right Christian Democrats. "It worries people." France and Italy also have seen increases in poverty and crime in immigrant communities. Are there other causes? Yes, economic insecurity is rising across the continent, creating a sense of scarcity and competition for resources. And as Europe becomes more multicultural and power moves from national capitals to the European Union, some people also feel a loss of national identity. It has all combined to lead a growing number of people to embrace nationalist populism and parties that were once stigmatized as extremist and racist. "If your house is burning down," said Ellefsen, "you call the fire brigade. You don't think about how it started." What do these parties stand for? Far-right parties throughout the continent are united in their support for law and order, populism, and nativism. Most have a strong authoritarian flavor. In policy terms, the radical right wants to strictly limit immigration, prioritize native-born citizens over newcomers, and rein in the power of educated elites. Some of these parties have been around for decades. France's national rally celebrated its 50th anniversary this year, but they were long considered fringe actors with no chance of gaining mainstream support. Who supports them now? Far-right voters were once largely male, uneducated, old, and rural. But in recent years, a much wider swath of the population has joined them, including young people. In Sweden, home to climate activist Greta Thunberg, more than 20% of 18 to 21-year-olds voted for the Sweden Democrats, even though the party downplays climate change. With many far-right parties promoting traditional gender roles, men continue to outnumber women in their ranks. But now female leaders such as Meloni, the national rally's Marine Le Pen, and Alternative for Germany's Alice Weidel are encouraging people to reject the rapid pace of demographic and cultural change. There is evidence the gender gap is shrinking in some countries, said Ilko Hartveld, who researches populism at the University of Amsterdam. How do far-right parties govern? When they win elections, they often seek to entrench their control with anti-democratic measures. Since Viktor Orban, leader of the far-right Fidesz party, was elected Prime Minister of Hungary in 2010, he has gained control of the courts, censored and taken control of the media, and virtually neutered the opposition. His success has made him an icon to far-right leaders around the globe, including in the U.S., where he has been celebrated at CPAC and on Fox News. Last month, the European Parliament passed a resolution saying that Hungary can no longer be considered a full democracy, calling Orban's government a hybrid regime of electoral autocracy. Poland is next in line for this transformation. Its far-right Prime Minister, Mateusz Morawiecki, from the Law and Justice Party, called Meloni's win in Italy a great victory. France's far-right leader Le Pen, meanwhile, rejoiced over Sweden Democrats' success, saying, "Everywhere in Europe, people aspire to take their destiny back into their own hands." And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll read two from the U.S., starting with "When States Intervene in Kids' Lives." The culture wars are entering a disturbing new phase as states seek to disrupt the bond between parents and children, said David French. California and Texas have each decided that in the divisive issue of puberty blockers and other gender reassignment treatment, the government can overrule parents' wishes for their child's care. California Governor Gavin Newsom last week signed a bill that authorizes minors to travel to the state to obtain life-altering medical interventions without their parents' knowledge or consent. This means one parent and a divorced couple, family members, or other adults could enroll kids in a treatment program that parents object to. On the other side of the divide, Texas Governor Greg Abbott now insists the state has the right to block all gender reassignment procedures, even when parents consent to those treatments. This law, like California's, violates the longstanding Supreme Court precedent that parents have the primary role in the upbringing of their children. Whatever one's views on this contentious issue, it is an egregious abuse of state power to sever the bond between parent and child. How to treat gender dysphoria should remain a parental and family decision, not the government's. Changing the climate message. It's shocking, frankly, how little Americans care about climate change, said Nicholas Goldberg. A recent poll found that the issue ranks near the bottom of concerns voters claim will influence their decisions in the midterm elections. Only 30% of voters say they are very worried about it. How can people remain so blithely unconcerned when we are already seeing proof that a warming climate brings more chronic drought, oppressive heat waves, destructive flooding, and severe storms? Climate scientists and activists are putting too much faith in scientific studies and the steady accretion of irrefutable facts to change minds. Instead, as public relations veteran David Fenton argues in the Activist Media Guidebook, they should adopt the tactics of marketers. Simple messages that are repeated over and over, compelling narratives about how climate change hurts real people, and an emphasis on the new jobs and shared prosperity that clean, renewable energy will bring. In Felton's words, sacrifice doesn't sell. The fate of the planet depends on awakening and mobilizing a distracted, disinterested citizenry to rise to the great challenge of modern times. This column comes from Europe. Britain, a new prime minister's calamitous start. In just 4 weeks, UK Prime Minister Liz Truss has offered a master class in how not to run a country, said The Economist. Taking office amid soaring inflation, spiking interest rates, and fears of recession, Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, promptly kick-started a crisis by announcing £45 billion, that's $48 billion, in unfunded tax cuts, including elimination of a 45% tax rate on the highest incomes. Two-thirds of the cuts would go to the wealthiest Britons. This supposed supply-side stimulant to economic growth alarmed investors, sending the pound plummeting and interest rates soaring, forcing the Bank of England to promise to buy long-term bonds on whatever scale is necessary to prevent a panic. Nonetheless, the monthly cost of variable rate mortgages held by most homeowners soared, creating huge resentment. With criticism even from Truss's own Conservative Party mounting, people are already asking how long Truss may last. Under enormous pressure, said Larry Elliott in The Guardian, Truss reversed course this week, announcing that the 45% top tax rate would be restored. But an already weak economy has suffered unnecessary damage, and after policy mistake, this foolish support for Truss and Finance Minister Kwarteng may never recover. Truss may well take her party down with her, said Katie Balls, also in The Guardian. A YouGov poll shows the Labour Party surging to a stunning 33-point lead over the Tories, the biggest gap in decades. The poll numbers and angry public reaction have sparked panic among party leaders, who expect they'll only worsen as their policies bring painful consequences for swaths of voters. Yes, Truss is in a bind, said Patrick O'Flynn in The Spectator, but all is not lost. She can turn this around if she stands up to a hysterical media and communicates clearly with the public about her conservative economic goals to make work pay, make enterprise profitable, and make welfare a safety net again and not a long-term lifestyle option. Sorry, but there's no coming back from this debacle, said Ian Dunt in inews.co.uk. We've just witnessed one of the most unhinged economic interventions of our lifetime. Truss's hero, Margaret Thatcher, cut spending to pay for her tax cuts rather than adding them to the deficit. Ronald Reagan spent freely while cutting taxes, but he did so with a strong currency to protect him. That's a key distinction lost on Truss and other Tory elites, so engrossed with the U.S. as to confuse it for their own nation, said Jana Ganesh in Financial Times. Britain doesn't issue the world's reserve currency, nor does it have near limitless demand for its sovereign debt. Now isolated by Brexit, the British still suffer from the delusion that a mid-sized archipelago can mimic the economic policies of the U.S. or dictate beneficial terms of trade deals with the EU or other nations. Give trust this at least. It is a kind of patriotism to mistake your nation for a superpower. Last word, our feature article, titled this week, Riding South to Freedom. While most slaves escaping the southern states went north, said Richard Grant in Smithsonian Magazine, thousands traveled over the Rio Grande to seek refuge in Mexico. Before the Civil War, numerous enslaved people made the treacherous journey to Mexico in a bold quest for freedom that historians are now unearthing. Until recently, the Southbound Underground Railroad, as some scholars call it, has been largely overlooked, mainly because it left so few traces in surviving records. No one who escaped slavery by going to Mexico wrote a first-hand account of the experience, as Frederick Douglass and others did about escaping north. And though the journeys of enslaved people to Mexico are of the utmost importance, the scale of the southern migration was more modest, numbering between 3,000 and 10,000 people, compared with an estimated 30 to 100,000 who fled north of the Mason-Dixon line. But scholars have begun to uncover a wealth of information about the southbound freedom seekers. Perhaps no one has done more to advance our understanding than a historian named Alice Baumgartner. In 2012, as a Rhodes Scholar studying violence on the U.S.-Mexico border in the early and mid-19th century, she was hunting through state and municipal archives in northern Mexico. She found plenty of documents about cattle rustling and Lipan Apache raids, but she also came across records of a completely unexpected kind of violence between American slave catchers crossing the Rio Grande and Mexicans who fought against them. Baumgartner, now an assistant professor of history at the University of Southern California, found correspondence from four councilmen from the Mexican border town of Guerrero who pursued, shot, and killed a slaveholder who had kidnapped a runaway. In 1851, the residents of another village in the state of Coahuila took up arms to stop a slave catcher named Warren Adams from abducting a black family. Months later, the Mexican army posted a sizable force and two artillery pieces on the Rio Grande to prevent a group of 200 Texans from crossing the border to seize runaway slaves. Baumgartner kept uncovering information that surprised and fascinated her. After independence from Spain in 1821, Mexico passed these really radical anti-slavery laws, and Mexicans at all levels of society were serious about enforcing them, she told me. This was well known by enslaved people on the U.S. side of the border. Indeed, more than three-quarters of the fugitive slaves caught in Texas between 1837 and 1861, she learned from a database of runaway slave notices, were heading to Mexico. The earliest examples of slaves escaping south are from the late 17th century. In the Carolinas, enslaved men and women ran away from the rice plantations to Spanish Florida, where they were able to arm themselves against their former enslavers. In 1693, King Charles II of Spain decreed that all fugitive slaves would be free in Florida. In 1733, a caveat was added. To gain their freedom, fugitives had to convert to Catholicism and declare loyalty to the Spanish crown. After the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, the de facto border between the United States and New Spain was the Sabine River, in present-day East Texas. This border was formalized in 1819. It's impossible to say how many enslaved people made it across the Sabine, but we know that slaveholders in Louisiana complained about escapes to New Spain. Thomas Marietti, a French historian at the University of Duisburg-Essen in Germany, has found evidence that 30 slaves from plantations on the Cane River near Natchitoches left for New Spain in October 1804. 9 crossed the Sabine River, and a string of similar escape attempts followed. Even though slavery existed in New Spain, American runaways were usually granted asylum by the Spanish authorities because the American form of slavery was regarded as far more brutal and dehumanizing. In New Spain, for example, slaves were subjects of the Spanish crown, not property, and it was illegal to separate husbands and wives or to impose excessive punishments. A fugitive named Richard, who made it across the Sabine, declared that the harshness of the American laws, as well as keeping his family together, were the reasons for his escape. In 1821, after Mexico won its independence, it opened the northern frontier state of Tejas, as Texas was then called, to Anglo-American settlers. Many of those settlers brought black slaves and established American-style cotton plantations in present-day East Texas. This set up a conflict with the Mexican government, which banned the importation of enslaved people in 1824. The Anglo colonists routinely ignored the law. In 1836, Texas won independence from Mexico and, now an autonomous republic, enshrined slavery in its constitution. Mexico fully abolished slavery the following year. In 1845, Texas joined the United States as a slave state. Then came the Mexican-American War of 1846-48. Defeat forced Mexico to relinquish all or parts of the present-day states of California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Wyoming. In 1849, Mexico's Congress decreed that foreign slaves would become free by the act of stepping on the national territory. This soon became common knowledge among enslaved people in Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, and what would later become Oklahoma. They envisioned what historian Michaela Audain, an associate professor at the College of New Jersey, calls a Mexican Canaan across the Rio Grande, a promised land where they could be free. Escaped slaves made the arduous journey through Texas. They stowed away on boats, leaving from Galveston and New Orleans for Tampico and Veracruz. In the 1850s, a dozen slaves were reaching Matamoros, Mexico, every month. 270 arrived in Laredo, in Tamaulipas, now called Nuevo Laredo, just across the border from Laredo, Texas, in a single year. American diplomats kept pressuring their Mexican counterparts to sign extradition treaties, which would return runaway slaves to their owners. But Mexico flatly refused in 1850, 51, 53, and 57. Most northbound runaways were on foot and unarmed, but many southbound freedom seekers, especially from Texas, rode horses and carried guns. It was a reflection of the culture and the most effective strategy, said Audain. They could travel faster, defend themselves, and hunt for food. Escaping on horseback probably also helped to neutralize the much-feared bloodhounds and other slave-hunting dogs. The dogs had no clear scent to follow and likely couldn't keep up with the horses over long distances. Baumgartner has noted the ingenuity many escaping slaves showed. They forged passes to give the impression they were traveling with the permission of their masters. They disguised themselves as white men, fashioning wigs from horsehair and pitch. They stole horses, firearms, skiffs, dirk knives, fur hats, and in one instance, 12 gold watches and a diamond breastpin. For the great majority, the journey south was an improvisation, a wayfinding through an unknown and hostile geography. They lived by their wits on a constant knife edge of danger. For those on foot, the journey could take months. Often pursued by their enslavers or hunted by slave patrols, with a bounty on their heads that any citizen might attempt to collect, they had to find food and water and contend with the Texas climate, well over 100 degrees in summer, and subject to sudden freezing blue norther storms in winter. Native Americans were another threat. The most dangerous part of the journey was the Nueces Strip, a 100 to 150-mile expanse of remote, thorny, rattlesnake-infested brush country between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande. It contained few roads or settlements, which made it hard to navigate and find food, and very little water. There was no slavery this far south in Texas because the risk of slaves escaping to Mexico was too great. Black people were highly conspicuous and immediately suspected of being fugitives. For Audain, the most affecting stories are those that end with drownings in the Rio Grande. I think of all the effort they put into planning their escape, walking hundreds of miles across Texas, and managing to avoid kidnappers and patrols, she says. They somehow survived these challenges, only for their journeys to end not with freedom, but with death. Most runaways arrived in Mexico with little or no Spanish. A few were able to establish themselves as merchants, carpenters, and bricklayers in Matamoros and other cities. For the great majority, however, there were two options. They could find work as servants or day laborers or on ranches and haciendas, or they could risk their lives once again by joining military colonies. These were fortified outposts established by the Mexican government to defend its northeastern borderlands from devastating raids for livestock, captives, and plunder by Comanches and Lipan Apaches. In return for such military service, according to a law passed by Mexico's Congress in 1846, foreigners, including runaway slaves, would receive land and full citizenship. Historians know little about the experience of African Americans in these military colonies, with one significant exception. At a colony in Coahuila were black Seminoles, descended from free black people and slaves who had run away from Georgia and the Carolinas and allied themselves with the Seminole Indians in Florida. They had fought with the tribe in three Seminole wars against the U.S. Army. When they were finally defeated, the Seminoles and black Seminoles were forced onto the Creek Reservation in Indian Territory, in present-day Oklahoma, with most arriving by 1842. The Creeks denied the newcomers land and started capturing black Seminoles and selling them into slavery in Arkansas and Louisiana. By 1849, says Baumgartner, the Seminoles and their black allies had had enough. The Seminole leader Wildcat, with the assistance of John Horse, leader of the black Seminoles, led more than 300 men, women, and children, including 84 black Seminoles, from Indian Territory south to Mexico. In northern Coahuila, the Mexican government granted them a 70,000-acre military colony with work animals, agricultural equipment, and financial subsidies. Runaway slaves started arriving before the colonists had finished clearing fields and building their wood frame houses. One man named David Thomas had escaped with his daughter and three grandchildren. In 1850, a group of 17 arrived, asking to join the black Seminoles. By 1851, there were 356 black people living at the colony, and three-quarters of them were runaway slaves. At a moment's notice, all the adult males had to be ready to fight against the Comanches or Apaches, arguably the most formidable Native American warriors on the continent. In her book, Baumgartner describes an early morning scene at the outset of a military campaign. Bright kerchiefed heads appeared in the low doorways of the houses. Women unhobbled the horses, slipping bits into their mouths. Then the men emerged, a powder horn and a bullet pouch slung across the shoulder, a machete or a horse pistol in hand. The Black Seminoles, known as Muscogos in Mexico, had a well-earned reputation as superb trackers and fighters. On foot or on horseback, according to the historian Kenneth Porter, who gathered their oral histories in the 1940s, the stronger men would use muskets as clubs. They beat down buffalo hide shields, splintered lat shafts, and rammed the iron-shod stocks under their enemies' astonished faces. Others used machetes to hack off spear and lance points and then decapitate their foes. In a battle known in the oral history as the Big Fight, 30 or 40 Black Seminoles defeated a much larger force of Comanches and Apaches, and much of the fighting was hand-to-hand combat. Descendants of the Black Seminoles and the runaways who joined them are still living in the town of El Nacimiento de los Negros, literally the birth of the blacks, in northeast Coahuila. Every year on June 19th, they stage a celebration with dancing and barbecues. The women dress up in long polka-dot pioneer dresses. The children sing songs in old African-American dialect of English that can be found in Negro spirituals. Only recently, according to Baumgartner, did the villagers learn their tradition is connected to Juneteenth, which celebrates the end of slavery in the United States. In Nacimiento, she said, it's called Dia de los Negros, or Day of the Blacks. This was adapted from a story originally published in Smithsonian Magazine. I think we have time for one of the short talking point articles. Midterms. Will the polls be wrong again? As the midterms loom, a nagging question is taking center stage, said Stephen Shepard in Politico. Can the polls be trusted? Recent polls in key races have shown Democrats running stronger than once expected, boosting their hopes of holding the Senate and possibly even the House in a year when historical trends in President Biden's mediocre approval rating suggested major GOP gains. But since Donald Trump stunned the political establishment with an upset win in 2016, polls have consistently understated support for Republican candidates. It happened again in 2020 when both national and state polls overestimated Democratic results by 4 to 5 points. Embarrassed pollsters have been tweaking their methods to try to sample more working-class Republican voters. But an easy fix has proven elusive, leaving many wondering whether Democrats' improved prospects are a mirage. The warning signs are flashing again, says Nate Cohn in the New York Times. Democratic Senate candidates are outrunning expectations in the places where polls most undercounted Trump support in 2016 and 2020. A prime example is Wisconsin, where polls showing incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson struggling have exceeded Democrats' wildest expectations. In 2020, polls overestimated Biden's Wisconsin margin by 8 points. Polls show a surprisingly tight Senate race in Ohio, a solidly Republican state where Trump won resoundingly twice, said Mark Weaver in the Washington Post. The reason for such polling bias is fairly obvious. Trump voters distrust pollsters and the media and simply won't participate out of protest or paranoia. Overall, the response rates to polls are in steep decline, said Nate Silver in 538. so it's harder for pollsters to reach an accurate cross-section of voters. But it's a mistake to presume current polls are biased toward Democrats. Evidence shows that polling bias is unpredictable, and assumptions about which party is favored are often wrong. In several recent races, Democrats actually outperformed their poll numbers, such as an August special House election in New York, where Democrat Pat Ryan won despite polls showing him as many as 14 points behind. Lately, Democrats have been on a winning streak, with gas prices falling, Biden's approval rate rising, and abortion bans galvanizing liberal voters. My advice? Prepare for the polls to be wrong, in either direction. Here's a short note or two. Both men and women in America weigh on average about 30 pounds more than they did in the 1960s. About 40% of the population is now considered obese, and projections say it will be 50% by 2030. So-called swing voters who sometimes cast ballots for candidates of different parties now account for just 3% of the U.S. electorate, an analysis of YouGov polling data found. From 1940 through 1960, switchers accounted for 12 to 20% of the electorate. And we'll finish out with a quote from John Gardner, quoted in Money Magazine, who says, "History never looks like history when you're living through it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.